of Jonathan's guard, and Katie had no idea how she would fight off such a challenge. Jonathan himself would back her, but Katie shouldn't need Jonathan to intercede. That would only confirm her lack of authority. The problem went round and round in her head, but she could see no answer that didn't include throwing Gavin out of the guard. Of course, all of these disagreements had to be hushed up outside their circle. To the town, the seven of them were merely Jonathan's friends, and one of them was with him at all times. At night, a member of the guard slept on the spare bed they had moved into Jonathan's living room. There was much grumbling about night duty, and Katie knew that most of them, Gavin and his people at least, thought she was being alarmist. Katie didn't care. There was still no sign of the violence that William Tyr had foreseen, but she didn't doubt that it was coming, and she was determined to spot it far in the distance. She had made Tyr a promise, and that promise seemed to mean infinitely more now that he was dead. Some days she still felt as though she and the others were children, merely playing at adult business. But they had no alternative. There was no one else. She knew that Ro Finn had completed 2 expeditions with Jen Devlin's team of mountaineers, and that, a month ago, he had left on a 3rd. As Ro's friend, she also knew that he was no more interested in exploring than she was. But it was only from Jonathan that she learned what Ro was seeking up there in the mountains. Sapphire. The same sapphire that lay around Jonathan's neck. Everyone had found small chunks of the stuff from time to time. It seemed to underlie the bedrock of the town. But in the mountains, the sapphire was much easier to get to, much easier to chip out in large, unbroken pieces. Jonathan knew this, and so Katie knew it as well, but she didn't understand precisely what Ro would want with that sapphire, or what he meant to do with it, if he could bring some back. She did know Ro well enough to know that if there was something of value in the world, he would certainly want it for himself. And so, in the past 2 years, she had found herself looking at her old friend with something worse than regret. Suspicion. When Ro was not off exploring the mountains, he went to church every day. He was popular there, so popular that sometimes Paul Anscott let him give sermons. Katie had listened in a couple of times, though she was forced to do so from a stand of oaks across the road. Ro's sermons were so popular that people spilled out the back door and onto the porch. Katie would listen, biting her nails while Ro's voice boomed through the packed doorway, talking about chosen people, people who were better and more deserving. He did have an excellent voice for a preacher, even Katie had to admit, deep and imbued with emotion that Katie suspected was wholly ersatz. There was an undertone of ruthlessness in Ro's sermons that Katie was not sure others would catch. After all, she had once known him better than anyone. He had always been a consummate actor. The question was how much of the boy had filtered into the man. From Gavin, Katie knew that the church accepted Ro's trips to the mountains as a pilgrimage, 40 days wandering in the wilderness or some such thing. And this, too, made her uneasy. Ro would enjoy the parallel with Christ. Always he had felt cheated by his lack of status in town. If Ro wanted to gull his church, Katie would shed no tears for them. But the idea of so many gullible people at any one man's beck and call seemed inherently dangerous. To Jonathan? She didn't know. In some ways, Jonathan was the biggest mystery of all. Katie often wondered why he should need a guard, when he knew so much more, saw so much more than the rest of them. Sometimes it felt as though their guard was entirely for show. But Katie didn't know who they were trying to fool. Sometimes she even wondered whether William Tyr had had any plan at all, or whether he had assembled them and trained them, simply on a whim. Katie had the ability to kill a man with her bare hands. But how did that benefit anyone when she couldn't even see the enemy she was fighting? "What's wrong with this place?" she demanded of Jonathan one day, on their way to the library. People waved and smiled at them, but even Katie could feel the great vacancy behind these greetings, sensed the smiles melting the moment they turned away. Something in the town had become twisted, and until Katie could find the end of the thread, there was no way to unravel it. "They forgot," Jonathan replied. "They forgot the very first lesson of the crossing." "Which is what?" Katie hated when Jonathan talked about the crossing. He knew plenty about it, more than anyone else their ages, but he would only parcel out the information in tiny nuggets. "We take care of each other." Jonathan shook his head. "Even the original members of the Blue Horizon seem to have forgotten."
"Not Mum,"
Katie snapped. "She knows." "Much good it does."
"What does that mean?"
Unexpectedly, Jonathan took her hand. Katie thought about pulling away, but didn't. Jonathan's hand was warm, not unpleasant. And after all, what did she care if people saw them holding hands? Half the town thought they were sleeping together anyway. It was a source of great amusement to the rest of the guard.
"Your mum is broken, Katie," he told her. "I'm sorry to say it, but her life was wrapped up in my father, and without him, she has nothing to keep her running."
Katie began to protest, but something silenced her. A voice inside that no longer allowed her to argue with the unpalatable truth. Every year that voice became stronger. Katie resented it sometimes, but it was often useful. Particularly in a town where so much now depended upon the politics of pragmatism. Mum wasn't right, hadn't been right since William Tyr had left. She went through the motions of her everyday life, but Katie almost never saw her smile anymore, and it had been months since she had heard Mum laugh. Mum was broken, and she wasn't alone. Tyr's departure had torn the guts from the town, and the longer he failed to return, the more Katie saw her community as a pack of wolves fighting over the carcass. At the last meeting, Todd Perry had called for a vote to allow people to carry knives in town. Jonathan, Katie, and Virginia had weighed in heavily on the other side, and the motion was defeated by a narrow margin. But they couldn't deceive themselves about which way the wind was blowing. "I hate them sometimes," Jonathan remarked quietly. "It's not how my father would have felt, but I do. Sometimes I think, if they want to walk around armed and build fences and let a church tell them what to do, let them wallow in it. They can build their own town of closed thinking and live there, and find out later what a shitty place it really is. It's not my problem." For a moment, Katie was too shocked to reply, for Jonathan had never expressed such ideas before. With his guard, he was the eternal optimist. There was nothing that couldn't be fixed. And now she was alarmed by the hopeless tenor of his words. She had promised William Tyr that she would protect Jonathan, and she had always assumed that such protection, if it came to that, would be an act of knives. But now she wondered whether Tyr might not have meant this moment, right here.
Memory overtook her. Sitting with William Tyr in the backyard 5 years ago now, the sapphire clutched in her fist. Had Tyr known, even then?
You're right, she said. It's not how your father would have felt.
I'm not my father.
That doesn't matter, Jonathan. You're all we have left.
I don't want it, he snapped, dropping her hand.
They were in front of the library now, and at the sharpness in Jonathan's voice, several children on the bench looked up, their eyes keen at the prospect of an argument.
Too bad, Katie replied.
She felt for Jonathan, she truly did, and some nights, lying in her narrow bed, she thought that she might feel for him quite a bit. But this wasn't the time for sympathy. A guard was like a stone wall, and good stone didn't yield. Good stone cracked right down the middle before it would give an inch.
She lowered her voice, mindful of the children listening in, perfect little receivers, ready to carry the conversation back to their parents.
No one ever wants the fight, Jonathan. But if it comes to you, and it's a righteous fight, you don't walk away.
What if we're destined to lose?
You don't know that.
Don't I?
He demanded. His hand had crept up toward his chest, and Katie knew that he was clutching the sapphire that lay just beneath. The desperation in the gesture, the dependency it revealed, made Katie suddenly furious, and she snatched his hand away, feeling like a hypocrite as she did so, for she understood Jonathan's hatred, his contempt for these people, who were too stupid to know that their future danced on the edge of a knife. A future of rich and poor, of violence and swords, of people bought and sold.
How do you know that?
I don't know, but I do. This was true. It was as though someone else were inside her head, knowing it for her. The knowledge made her sick, but she thrust it away, focusing on Jonathan.
You don't know anything, she hissed.
I don't give a fuck about magic or visions. The future isn't set. We can change it at any time.
Jonathan stared at her for a long moment, and then, unexpectedly, he smiled.
Are you laughing at me? She demanded.
No, he replied. Just remembering something my father said before he left.
What?
He said that I had picked the right guard, that you were the one to carry us through.
For a moment, Katie couldn't reply. Her anger vanished, and she was suddenly moved. Moved beyond description, to discover that after all these years, she had not been found wanting in William Tyr's eyes. He had chosen her to guard his son.
Crisis over, Jonathan muttered and shook his head ruefully. But not for long. You might not believe my visions, but I know when trouble's on the way, and there's bad trouble coming down the pike.
He did know. Katie admitted reluctantly to herself, but she shrugged it off and took his hand again, tugging him toward the library.
Not this afternoon, Sybil. Now hurry up.
3 days later, Roe Finn walked back into town, alone. He must have been 30 pounds lighter, his clothing torn and ruined, and his carrying pack barely in one piece. His steps were stumbling, and he appeared to be delirious. When he saw Ben Markham and Elissa Wu, who were fishing on the banks of the Cadell, he collapsed. The story passed like quicksilver through the town. According to Mrs. Finn, who jealously guarded her son from visitors, the expedition had become lost in the high mountains, and they had succumbed, one by one, to exposure and starvation. Roe had lasted the longest, and it was only by barest chance that he had found a narrow, natural trail that led him down a pass. He had survived the journey home by eating such roots and berries as he was able to forage in the great forest. The town believed this story. Katie did not. She had not seen Roe yet, but she had heard plenty. His church flocked to him, determined to fatten him up. Virginia, who had gone over to see Roe 2 days before, said the house was full of food, baked goods and soups. "Women, too," Virginia told Katie grimly. "Awful lot of women in that church, like seeing Roe Finn bedridden, I can tell you that." For the rest of the mountain expedition, the town had a rare, united moment of genuine mourning. Jen Devlin, in particular, was an enormous loss. They held a single service for the 11 dead, a service through which Katie stood, dry-eyed, watching not the various people who spoke in memory of the dead, but the Finn House, clearly visible 2 streets down the hill. She was desperate to question Roe, but she didn't want an audience when she did so. The conversation would not be a good one. She didn't want to suspect her old friend, but she couldn't help it. In the end, it took her more than a week to find him alone. Roe's church was off on some sort of prayer retreat in the plains for 2 days, and his mother had gone to a card party. Roe's tale had made Mrs. Finn a much sought-after guest, and Katie liked the woman even less for the grasping and desperate embrace of her fleeting popularity. The sight of her happily following a group of women, women who'd wanted nothing to do with her until now, made Katie want to shake the woman awake. Katie didn't bother to knock before entering the Finn's house. When she reached Roe's room, she found him on his side in bed, his eyes closed, his face that of an angel in repose. The weight he had lost only made him better looking, his cheekbones like carved marble. Katie couldn't help wondering who Roe would have been if he'd been born without that face. "I know you're shamming, Roe." His eyes popped open and he smiled.
"You always know, don't you, Katie?"
"About you, I do." She dragged up a chair. There were several spread around the bed. "Hiding from all your guests?"
"They do wear me out."
She looked around the room, taking in the homemade bouquets and boxes of baked goods, and gave a derisive snort. "I suppose that's the price of being the new Messiah, isn't it?"
"I'm not the Messiah," Roe replied, smiling pleasantly, but his eyes held their same old devilry. "Just the devout man."
"Why don't you tell me what happened to you out there?"
"That story's all over town by now."
"It is." She smiled, but her smile wasn't as genuine as Roe's. It felt like winter on her mouth. "But I'd like to hear your story."
"Don't you trust me, Katie?"
"Don't play with me, Roe. What happened?" He told her substantially the same story she had already heard, lost in the mountains, the expedition dying slowly of starvation and cold. He had outlasted them by rationing his food carefully and by huddling for warmth with the 2 horses until they too had succumbed. There were only 2 points where Katie sensed Roe fiddling with the truth. The food rationing and the trail he had found down the mountain. But Katie couldn't make him shake his story, and finally she gave up and leaned back in the chair, unsatisfied.
"Didn't you miss me, Katie?"
Katie blinked. She had missed him, though she hadn't realized it until this moment. Things were more interesting with Ro around. That hadn't changed, even if everything else had. But at the same time, the town felt safer with Ro gone.
"I missed you, Katie."
"Why?"
"Because you know me. It's useful to have everyone think I'm good, I suppose. But it's tiring, too."
"I knew your church nonsense was a lie."
"Brother Paul is dying."
Katie blinked at the abrupt change of subject. "Of what?"
"Cancer, Mr. Miller thinks. Brother Paul should live out the rest of the year, but not much longer. And the pain may force him to end his own life long before that."
"Is he allowed to end his own life? I thought that was a sin."
"Maybe. But for most people, faith is a pretty flexible business."
"I've noticed."
Ro grinned. "It doesn't have to be a bad thing, Katie. The faithful are easy. Easy to convince, easy to direct, easy to discard. When Brother Paul dies, he'll hand the church off to me."
"What do I care?" Katie asked, but inside she felt a chill. She thought of the packed church she had seen at Ro's last few sermons, the glut of people pouring out onto the porch. How many? She wondered. 300? 4?
"You could help me, Katie."
"No."
"Think about it. God has made these people malleable. They'll believe any damn thing that comes out of Brother Paul's mouth."
"Or yours."
"Or mine. We could make so much use of that."
"To do what, Ro?" He grabbed her hand. If she had been talking to the new Ro, charming and false, a few moments ago, she saw now that he was sincere. That made it worse, somehow. She would rather hear this from her enemy than from her old friend. She wanted to yank her hand back, but then she stilled as Ro pulled a silver chain from beneath his shirt. Sapphire glimmered in the afternoon light. "Where did you get that?" she demanded. "It's Jonathan's."
"No, it's mine. I made my own."
"How?"
"You always thought William Tyr was perfect," Rose said with a chuckle. "But he's not."
That was no answer. But Katie's brow furrowed all the same, for she sensed an artful mixture of truth and lies in Ro's statement. Sensed that there was an answer there. If only she could riddle out what he meant.
"It works for me," Ro told her. "Just like it works for Jonathan. I see things. I know things. I know that the great saint is dead." Katie jumped up, knocking over her chair, and leaned over to grab his shoulders, slamming him back against the headboard.
"You'll keep your mouth shut, Ro."
"Think about it, Katie," he repeated, ignoring her. "Tyr is gone. The town we always talked about. The town where smart people like us would lead and the rest would follow. We could make it ourselves."
Katie wanted to protest that she had never thought any such thing, but she had. She remembered now. She had thought so many awful things when she was young. It hurt to remember them. Ro dislodged her hands from his shoulders, and belatedly, Katie realized that, starved or not, he was much stronger now. Katie saw devilment in his eyes. But not the harmless sort she remembered from when they were young. He tucked the silver necklace and its sapphire back underneath his shirt. "What about all the non-believers, people who don't belong to your church? You think they'll sit happily by?"
"They'll be gone."
The flat certainty of this answer made her cold, for she sensed violence in it. A vast, nascent shadow whose contours she could barely glimpse. "And what about me, Ro?"
"Oh, Rapunzel. I wouldn't let anything happen to you."
He grinned crookedly, just like the old Ro. And for a moment, Katie's guard wavered. All of her suspicion suddenly buried under nostalgia. They had been so close once, the two of them.
"What do you say, Katie?"
Despite everything, for a moment she was tempted to say yes, for even now, Ro's vision still had the power to sway her. The place they had talked about for years, a true meritocracy, with none of Tyr's ambiguous ideas to get in the way. She and Ro had planned it together, built it like a castle inside their heads. "But I'm a different person now," Katie realized. "All the resentment I used to feel, it doesn't bind me now. I can let it go." But could she? All the contempt she felt for the people in the town. Fools with so little sense of self that they needed to believe in an invisible god who would peek inside people's bedrooms. That contempt suddenly overwhelmed her. And she could see Rose's vision spread out before her. A town where such people were relegated to disenfranchisement, where their own foolishness was quarantined so that it could hurt no one. How wonderful it would be to live in a town where weak minds were punished, where people like Ro and Jonathan... "Now who's being a fool?" her mind demanded. "Jonathan? You really think there's room for Jonathan Tyr in Ro's paradise?" That brought reality back with a thud. Katie might not know how Ro meant to implement his grand plan, but she knew Ro. He had always hated the Tyrs, hated the idea of them even more than the people themselves. Jonathan was not William Tyr, perhaps, but he was far too dangerous to be allowed in Ro's kingdom. Katie stood up from her chair, feeling long-buried sorrow twist her insides. All those years ago, she had known that one day she would have to choose. But she hadn't known that it would have to be today. "I can't go with you, Ro," she told him. "I serve Jonathan Tyr." Ro's face tightened, but only for a moment. And then that spurious good humour reappeared.
"Ah, yes, the infamous fighting force."
Katie's mouth dropped open.
"Did you really think I wouldn't find out, Katie? There are no secrets in this town. I've always known that Tyr was a fraud, but you didn't, did you?"
"He wasn't a fraud!" she shouted, outraged. "It's for Jonathan! It's to guard Jonathan!" Ro smiled indulgently, as though she were a child.
"That's what Tyr told you, certainly. But think about it, Katie. It may look like a guard, but what Tyr was really training up is a police force, a secret police force, answerable only to his son. What sort of utopia needs secret police?
You think I don't know that you're jealous of Jonathan? She demanded, and had the pleasure of watching Ro's face darken. You've always been jealous of him. You've always wanted what he has.
And what about you?
I serve the tears, Katie repeated stubbornly. I serve Jonathan. Ro threw back his head and laughed.
See, Katie, you're one of the faithful too.
Katie grabbed him again, meaning to yank him from the bed. In that moment she hated Ro, hated him utterly, because she could already feel his words digging into her mind, making her think twice, making her doubt. But after another moment she released him and backed away. Jonathan was there, always, and it would not serve Jonathan if she picked a fight with the Christer's favourite son now. Ro stretched again, but this time he swung his legs out of bed and got up. He was wearing nothing beneath his sheet. Katie did her best to look away before it dropped, but she failed, and the brief glimpse she got made her feel like she was burning inside. Then she was ashamed. This was her oldest friend. What had happened to the two of them? When had everything changed?
How's that Messiah working out for you, Katie? Spotted any feet of clay yet?
You stay away from Jonathan. Don't even come near him.
I won't need to, Katie, Ro replied, grinning.
But now the grin seemed not appealing, but reptilian. She turned away, but a moment later her entire body spasmed as Ro slid a hand between her legs.
You look all you want, Katie.
I don't want to.
It must be exhausting, devoting all your time to a second-rate William Tyr. Why not trade up?
Katie's fists clenched. Beneath the excitement that had gathered in her belly, she felt a titanic wave of anger building. That he should think her such a fool, that he should treat her like one of the hundreds of other women in town who had already succumbed. They might not be friends any more, but surely she deserved better than that.
Tyr's paradise will collapse beneath Jonathan's feet, Katie, just as I knew it would. And who will people turn to in the wreck, if not God?
She fled then, ducking clumsily out of Ro's room, banging her shoulder on the frame as she went.
Think about it, Katie, Ro called after her. You're on a sinking ship. Come over to mine and just see how far we sail.
Katie stumbled down the hallway, her eyes full of tears. On her way down the steps, she bumped into Mrs. Finn and several other women, but she could not even bring herself to exchange pleasantries, could only shoulder past the women with a muttered apology, moving faster with each step. By the time she reached the bottom of the porch, she had broken into a run.
Lady.
Mace's voice. That was good, for even here, at the end of the world, she would have liked to see Mace one last time.
I know you hear me, lady. Will you wake up?
Kelsey didn't want to wake up. She could feel William Tyr's sapphire at her chest, almost like a companion that had accompanied her on strange journeys, but she was beginning to think that she had never needed the jewel to see into the past, for they were all with her now. Tyr, Jonathan, Lily, Katie, Dorian. even Roe Finn.
Lady, if you don't wake up, I'm going to have you baptized.
Her eyes popped open, and she saw Mace, sitting beside her bed, holding a candle. Around him was a darkened room. She sat up quickly.
Lazarus? Is it you?
Of course it's him.
Corin appeared out of the gloom.
As though you could mistake that set of shoulders for anyone else.
Kelsey reached out to Mace, but he did not take her hand. They stared at each other for a long moment.
I'll see myself out, Corin muttered. Glad you're well, lady.
When he opened the door, Kelsey saw a piece of hallway lit by torchlight. Then the door closed, and she and Mace were once again staring at each other. Kelsey was reminded, suddenly and painfully, of that day on the bridge. The chasm between them had been vast, but it felt even larger now. She read distrust in his eyes, and it hurt far more than anger. Where are we?
In the house of a woman who was loyal to your mother, Lady Chilton.
We're not in Gin Reach.
No, lady. About a day's ride north, in the southern Almont. You've been in fugue since we found you, 3 days ago.
3 days?
It was a long one, lady, and worrisome for the guard. We should let Penn in here soon, lest he begin to chew on the furniture.
Mace smiled, but the smile did not meet his eyes. You haven't forgiven me, Lazarus. He remained silent. What did you expect me to do?
Tell us, damn it. I would have gone with you.
Of course you would have, Lazarus. But I thought I was going to die. Why would I ask anyone to follow me there?
Because it's my job,
he roared, and his voice seemed to shake the timbers of the tiny space.
It's what I signed on for. The choice was mine, not yours.
I needed you to stay behind, Lazarus. I needed you to run the kingdom. Who else would I have trusted to get it done? At this, Mace's anger seemed to fade. He looked down at the floor, his cheeks coloring.
You chose wrong, lady. I failed.
What do you mean?
The keep is under siege.
By whom?
The Arvath, with a legion of Mort. Our people are holed up inside, but they won't hold out forever. New London is under the rule of the mob, but the mob, too, is directed by the Arvath.
Kelsey's hands tightened on the covers. Her knuckles were white, but she hoped that Mace wouldn't notice. The thought of the Holy Father in her keep, sitting on my throne, was like a dark hole inside her. The entire city, the entire kingdom, at the mercy of Anders' poisonous god. The thought made her inside seethe. But in this moment, Mace's doubt seemed even more pressing. It was as much my fault as yours, Lazarus, she said softly. Some days I wonder whether I shouldn't have let the cages roll.
You were trying to do the right thing, lady. It's not your fault that it went so wrong.
That made her think of Simon, of their long conversation in the dungeons. Whether the topic was physics or history, it made no difference. Trying to do the right thing so often ended in wrong. Kelsey shrank from the idea, for she felt it as the first step on the road to paralysis, an inability to make any decision at all for fear of unforeseen consequence.
But me, Mace continued, I left. We all left to get you out. We left the kingdom wide open so the Holy Father could steal it.
You can't have it both ways, Lazarus. Either the grey cloak stays on always, or it comes off for greater exigency. It was my fault, perhaps, for asking you to be both Queen's Guard and Regent. I'd imagine the two would often be at cross purposes.
Do not coddle me, lady.
Done is done, Lazarus. We both fell down. But you once told me there was nothing to be gained by dwelling on the past. The future now. That's everything. She extended her hand again. So what say we forgive each other so we can keep moving forward? For a long moment, Mace merely stared at her hand, and Kelsey waited, feeling, again, as though she stood before a precipice. The Red Queen's face surfaced briefly in her mind, then disappeared. It had been a long journey from that edge to this, but something told Kelsey that the journey wasn't done. And how could she go anywhere without Mace? Guard, voice of doubt, voice of conscience? She needed all of these things. Her throat constricted as Mace reached out and took her hand. Wide as God's ocean, she whispered. You remember?
I remember, lady.
He looked away, blinking, and Kelsey took the opportunity to stretch her arms and shoulders, which were still sore from Brenna's bonds. The news about the Holy Father roiled in her chest. She would have liked to go back and fix her own mistakes, but the roots of this problem went far deeper, all the way back to the fledgling settlement, the beginnings of the Tearling, where everything had begun to go wrong. Tyr was able to shuttle through time, she thought defiantly. And there had been times, deep in her fugues, when Kelsey felt as though she were almost doing the same, not just seeing, but travelling, as though she were actually there, in Lily's world, in Katie's. But she did not control it. Something was still missing. Lazarus, there was a man in the cell beside me, an engineer.
Simon, lady. We have him.
Kelsey smiled, relieved to hear some good news. God only knew what good a printing press would do the Tearling now, but still she was glad that Simon had gotten out. Where is he?
Downstairs. We can barely get Hall to concentrate on anything lately.
Twins, Kelsey replied, nodding. I see now.
Why did you want him anyway?
She explained about the printing press, expecting Mace to make a scathing remark about books or reading, but he listened quietly, and when she was done, he remarked,
That's valuable, lady.
Is it?
Yes.
And where is the real Lazarus? His mouth twitched.
I have been... reading.
Reading what?
Your books, lady. I've read 9 of them now.
Kelsey stared at him, genuinely surprised.
They're good. These stories.
Mace continued, his cheeks stained with light colour.
They teach the pain of others.
Empathy. Carlin always said it was the great value of fiction, to put us inside the minds of strangers. Lazarus, what of my library?
Still in the Queen's wing, lady, and under siege as well.
Kelsey's hands balled into fists. The idea of the Holy Father touching her books. For a moment she thought that she would be sick all over the bedspread.
Anyway, Mace continued, clearing his throat, I see the value of such a press. If we ever get past this, Arliss and I will help Simon acquire his parts.
Kelsey smiled, moved. I missed you, Lazarus. More than I missed the sunlight, even.
Did they harm you, lady?
She grimaced, thinking of the jailer, the beating, and she was ashamed. There had been plenty of other people in that dungeon. As a queen with something to trade, Kelsey had enjoyed a privileged position. Those others had had nothing. My suffering was real, she insisted. Perhaps, but do not let it blind you to those who suffer worse. No permanent harm, Lazarus, she finally replied. I will put it behind me. She looked around the room, at the candle-lit shadows that flickered on the wall. Somewhere, very distant, she heard people talking. Lady Chilton's house, you said? I don't know her. Mace sighed, and Kelsey saw that he was framing his words very carefully.
She is not... Well, lady, it will not be a risk-free accommodation.
What's wrong with her? Is she mentally unstable?
That would be a kind word for it, lady.
Then why are we here?
Because we needed a place to wait out your fugue, and Lady Chilton was willing to take us in. We couldn't stay in that damned border town, too much attention. This house is large enough to house the people we brought with us, and there are plenty of supplies. Lady Chilton was well prepared for siege when the Mort came through. Mostly, though, we're here because she owes me a great debt.
What sort of debt?
I saved her life once. She still remembers it.
What's wrong with her?
Her malady is not our business, lady. She has promised to stay in the upper floors away from you. I hope to be out of here by tomorrow.
Kelsey was still uneasy at this, but she had no options to offer. She looked down at herself and saw that she was still wearing the filthy clothes she had worn out in the desert. I need some clothes. Mace gestured toward the dresser.
Lady Chilton has loaned you a dress.
Thinking of the desert reminded Kelsey of the rest of that strange night as well, and she asked, Is Ewan here?
Yes, lady. We met up with him in Gin Reach, and a very strange tale he told us, too.
Strange, but true.
Ewan torments himself with the idea that he's not a real Queen's Guard. Mascot was the word he used. I sent him to Gin Reach only as a precaution. Never thought anything would happen to him there.
He saved my life, Lazarus. More, perhaps. Kelsey closed her eyes and saw Brenna's face an inch from her own, her gaze digging into Kelsey's mind, into Lily's mind beneath. We were both there, Kelsey realized suddenly. Both there at once, Lily and I. How can that be?
Well, I will tell the rest of the guard, lady. If Ewan played the part of a hero... They will honor him for it.
He did. She pushed back the covers. Toss me that dress. A few minutes later, Mace led her out into a long hallway lit by torches.
The walls were constructed not of the light grey stone that held up the keep, but of deep, sand-coloured blocks that appeared to have been etched by wind and time. A draught whipped down the hallway, ruffling Kelsey's hair and causing her to shiver.
"Poor insulation," Mace commented. "This place should have been upgraded at least 10 years ago, but Lady Chiltern has let it go to ruin."
"Did she come to my coronation? Why do I..." But she got no further, for Elston and Kib suddenly came skidding around the corner, half the guard behind them. Before Kelsey could even greet them, her hand was crushed in Elston's massive grip.
"Are you well, lady?"
he asked. "Fine, El."
"I prayed for you, lady,"
Dyer told her, and grinned as she slapped him lightly on the cheek. The sight of them made Kelsey smile, but at the same time she felt uneasy. Mace, Elston, Kib, Corin, Galen, Dyer, Kay, all around her were glad faces, beloved faces, people she had missed. But beneath her joy at seeing them again lay a feeling of doom, delayed and distant, but real all the same. If the keep was truly under siege, they were all exiles now. People without a home.
"Are you in pain, lady?" Corin asked. "I have my kit."
"I'm fine," she replied, accepting handshakes from Kib and Galen. Looking around, she found one face conspicuously absent. "Where's Penn?"
"I sent him off to ride the perimeter, lady," Elston replied. "There's no danger out here. We're on the plain, and any threat can be seen from miles away. But he was driving us all mad. Poor lovesick, remember yourself," Mace barked.
And Kelsey felt a blush colour her cheeks.
"Sorry, lady," Elston murmured,
but his eyes glinted with such good humour that Kelsey shook her head and swatted him on the shoulder. "Who else is here?" she asked.
"Hall and his people are downstairs, Levieux too, and he has requested a word with you when you have a moment."
"Levieux?"
"He was useful, lady, helping us break into the palais,"
Mace replied quickly, tipping her a look that said they would talk about it later. Kelsey nodded, but when she thought of the fetch, she could not picture the man, only the boy, Gavin. What did that mean? She looked past Elston and jumped. For a moment, she was sure that someone was standing down at the end of the corridor watching her. But when she blinked, the figure was gone.
"Lady?"
She turned to Mace. "I thought I saw someone, down there at the bend."
"You're still not well, lady."
Kelsey nodded, but the more she thought about it, the more she was certain that the figure had been there. A woman, in a long black dress and dark veil. Mentally unstable, she thought, and a thread of unease wormed its way inside her. "We'll leave in the morning," she told them.
"Lady?"
"You said that the keep was under siege, Lazarus. We can't simply stay here, hiding, while the kingdom burns. What sort of a queen would I be?"
"Ha!"
Dyer turned to Corin.
"That's 10 pounds.
Mace shook his head.
"We knew you were going to say that, lady. My only question was how long it would take to come out."
"Well, it's true."
"You have no army, lady. The Holy Father has an entire battalion of Mort mercenaries. The only thing you can accomplish by returning to New London is to get yourself killed."
Kelsey nodded, trying to take this advice to heart, to be the smart queen that she should have become.
But she couldn't wait out here, in the middle of nowhere, away from everything. What could be fixed that way?
Lady.
She turned, and there was Pen, coming from the other end of the hallway. Pen! She began to run down the corridor, but Mace grabbed her wrist.
Hold, lady.
What?
Things are no longer the same.
Mace turned to the rest of the guard.
All of you, back to your posts. You will see the Queen at dinner.
Her guards moved along, and Kelsey couldn't help noticing that they seemed suddenly anxious to be away. Within a few seconds, they had all disappeared around various corners.
Lady,
Pen reached them, bowed.
It's a pleasure to see you well.
She stared at him, confused. This cold man was not the Pen she knew. Then she remembered the scene on the bridge, and understood. Pen was angry with her, of course he was, just like Mace. She had fled from all of them, from her guard, straight into the arms of the enemy. She had tried not to think of Pen while she was in prison. But of course he had still been here, stewing in that betrayal. Well, she would make it up to him. She would...
Pen will no longer be your close guard, lady.
Mace said flatly.
What?
Starting tonight, Elston will take over Pen's duties.
Kelsey turned to stare at Pen, who in turn stared at the floor. What happened? She demanded.
I will give you two a few minutes, but only a few,
Mace replied, speaking to Pen.
After that, you will not be alone together again.
Pen nodded. But Kelsey turned on Mace.
You don't make changes to my guard behind my back, Lazarus. I didn't ask for a new close guard. This isn't your decision.
No, lady,
Pen said.
It's mine.
She turned back to him, her mouth falling open. They had been sleeping together, yes, but they could end that. There was no reason to change the guard. Pen? What is this?
A few minutes,
Mace repeated. Then he retreated down the hall toward Kelsey's room. Pen waited until Mace disappeared inside before raising his eyes to Kelsey. And she almost flinched at what she saw there. Utter professionalism. Nothing more. You don't want me any more, Pen.
I am a guard, lady. It's all I've ever wanted to be, ever since the captain found me.
He shrugged, smiling, and for a moment the ice broke and he was the old Pen, the Pen she knew.
I love you, lady. I think... I've loved you ever since you asked if you could help put up that damned tent. But while you were gone, I discovered that I cannot love you and be a Queen's Guard all at once.
Kelsey nodded, but the nod was reflexive. She didn't love Pen. Did she? She no longer knew. Sex had welded them, made them something far more than they were intended to be at the outset. Something moved over Penn's shoulder, and Kelsey thought she saw again a dark figure standing down at the end of the hall. Another blink, and it was gone. She returned her attention to Penn. Her pride was wounded. Of course it was. But if she gave in to that impulse, she would lose not just a bed partner, but a friend as well. She firmed her jaw, doing her best to conceal her disappointment. "Do you mean to remain on the guard?" she asked.
"Yes, lady.
but I will not be your close guard, and you will have to treat me as you treat the rest, or I can't stay." She nodded slowly, feeling something like sorrow break inside her. They had not had many nights,